Even when the weather and holiday traffic are frightful, the Allegheny Front's favorite place to be is outside. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. This week we explore memories of holidays spent outdoors and more recent experiences of the natural world around us.
Stream runs under icicles frozen on the waterfall. Nothing but tiny hemlocks are green.
This is the Allegheny Front's special holiday show. Please stay tuned. In winters past, Pittsburgh radio host Joey Spehar spent a lot of time outside. His family's business required it. The Spehars own a gas station in Pittsburgh's north side. For some years, full service included more than washing windows and checking oil. There was a special service offered after Thanksgiving.
My brother and I were cheap labor. We spent hours and hours outside on cold days, shoveling snow, scraping ice, carting around dollies stacked with cases of pop, slipping and sliding, and learning to appreciate sunshine and warmth. Our station has always been more of an old-time general store. We sell everything, from Fanta to finished nails to fine meats and cheeses in the deli. So with a big patch of unused real estate in the back corner of the lot, Christmas trees became an obvious choice to try to sell. The year was 1997. I was in the 8th grade. I think my brother Bobby was relieved when I won the coin toss. It decided which of us got to take the ride up to Indiana, PA with our dad, bright and early on the day after Thanksgiving. Bobby was never much for playing in the snow. Taking a ride in the dump truck always gave a magical feeling, which was mostly about how great it felt being out with Dad, acting like a grown-up, and working. It was exciting going to the nursery. We watched the guys who worked there toss trees taller than me onto the back of the truck, 50 of them to be exact. Inside the store, I picked out a tiny sapling that my dad promised to help me plant once we got back home, and we did. We stopped off at the barbecue joint along the way back for some ribs, beans, and cornbread, but when we got back to the gas station, these trees became work. Endless new varieties of work. The guys that loaded the trees onto our truck, they didn't make the ride back to help us take them back off. The trees needed to be unbaled, put into stands, and taken out in the morning for display by the front door. Then, we took them back in at night. Through the day, we picked up and showed off the trees as customers said, let me see this one. Okay, now that one. All right, I'm sorry. Let me see the third one that you had out. We always had to cut, rebale, and tie the trees to the roof of the customer's car. The branches were always wet. They were always cold. But these were some really fun times. When the trees were plentiful at the start of the season, I would jump back first into the pile of soft, cushiony trees. They smelled great, especially the silvery blue concolor firs. The needles made your hands smell like oranges. When branches were cut off, Bobby and I would beat each other senseless with them. It was awesome. We continued this tradition for about 7 years. Bobby and I took turns picking up the trees with our dad in the dump truck. It turned out to be the easier of the two jobs. Even though it meant being on the road at 6 a.m., it also meant that the other guy had to do most of the tree removal back at the gas station. But when the first 47 trees just earn your money back, and two of the three remaining trees end up going over the fence at midnight on the 22nd, some traditions must end. I miss those days some winters. But then I remember how cold it was. Cold and wet. Now, I just look at the Colorado blue spruce that I planted that first year, which now stands 12 feet tall in my parents' front yard. And that is all the reminder I need.
That was Joey Spehar for the Allegheny Front. He co-hosts the Morning Mix music program on 91.3 WYEP in Pittsburgh. Now that he's got a full-time job, a big dog, and a toddler on his hands, he's going with an artificial tree. Thanks for listening to this holiday special from the Allegheny Front.
Oh, Christmas tree, oh, Christmas tree, how lovely are your branches. Oh, Christmas tree, how lovely are your branches. Your boughs are green in summer's clime, and through the snows of wintertime. Christmas tree, oh Christmas tree, how steadfast are your branches.
The flip side of selling Christmas trees is the hunt for the perfect one that propels some families to great lengths. Pittsburgh Post-Gazette environment writer Don Hopi shares how his family's tree traditions have evolved.
I remember as a child going with my father and four younger brothers, sometimes my mom, from one Christmas tree lot to another, searching for just the right tree. It was nothing to stop at half a dozen of the lots where the ritual was always the same. We'd walk past the rusty burn barrels where sappy pine boughs were blazing and the tree lot guys huddled. One of us would point to a tree and my father would straighten it from where it was leaning against some of the other trees and then hand it off to one or more of us boys so that he could step back and size it up. If it passed that initial inspection, one of us would be left behind as a guard while the rest of the entourage continued the quest for the perfect tree or my dad's idea of one. This could go on for hours, even days. Our one solace was that none of us could ever remember not having a tree for Christmas. Despite the care my father put into selecting the tree, gaps in the branches appeared when we got it home. And for some reason, those bare spots couldn't be camouflaged by turning them toward the living room wall. So my father would get out his electric drill and a big drill bit and begin boring holes into the trunk of the tree. He'd then insert spare branches cut from the bottom of the tree and whittled to size into those holes to fill the gaps. As my own children have grown up, we followed a different holiday tradition. We go to the country to cut a live tree for Christmas. Of course, each of us sees the perfect Christmas tree a little differently. Some like long needles, others short. Some want a fat, bushy tree, more hedge-like than conical. Others like them taller, but full-figured. And there's always a vote for something so skinny, only Charlie Brown would wrap his arms around it. A while back, in an effort to restore peace in the countryside and end the annual two-public field battle over what tree to select, we decided to give each person a designated turn in the decision-making rotation. But now we fight over who selected last year's tree and who is next in line to select the tree this year. Democracy was never so messy as it is in the car rides to cut a tree. But the excursions are always memorable. There was the warm year my daughter found and picked up a slow-moving, foot-long garter snake sunning itself on the west-facing slope of a Christmas tree farm outside Houston in Washington County. There was the year we went to cut a tree so early in December that the tree farm wasn't open yet, but the owners allowed us to cut a tree anyway. When we went to the farmhouse to pay, we were greeted with a batch of fresh-baked cookies. There was the year we cut our tree at a farm near Lone Pine in Washington County. We stopped at the Springhouse in 84 for lunch and wound up getting a dog at the Washington Area Humane Society next door. And there was the year it was so windy that on the way home we almost lost the tree on the highway, though my poor job of tying it to the roof may have also contributed to the problem. There was the year we cut a tree growing on a hillside and then couldn't get its crooked trunk to stand straight in the tree stand. And there was the year it was really snowy. We wrapped the kids in coats and blankets and pulled them on sleds to a grove of blue spruce we hadn't visited before. They had fun sledding while I moved through the stand, putting a hat on one tree, a scarf on another, a glove on another, gradually disrobing to mark the many fine finalists. Now the kids are too old to pull around on sleds, but this year, we still went to cut a tree. We went to Beaver County. My son Jack got to pick. He picked a great tree, but there was a small gap in it. We didn't get out the drill like my dad would have. May your holidays be merry, and may you enjoy the voices raised in family debates big and small around your tree. And revel in nature's perfect imperfections.
That was reporter Don Hopi. He's president of the Society of Environmental Journalists. He shared a picture of this year's tree and his daughter that you can see at AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to this special holiday edition of the Allegheny Front. Next week, we have an in-depth report, the coming chemical boom, by Allegheny Front Energy correspondent Reed Frazier. He visited the Gulf Coast earlier this year, and he got a sense of what might be in store for our region if the shale gas industry fuels a plastics sector.
They are just actually dismantling another plant in Chile and moving it to this area.
The coming chemical boom, next time on the Allegheny Front. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from Table Magazine, sharing food, culture, and lifestyle in Western Pennsylvania. The winter issue includes inspiring food gifts, tricks for hosting dinner parties of all sizes, and the best dark beers of the season. Table Magazine's winter issue is on newsstands now. More information is available at tablemagazine.com.
'Tis the season for winter camping. Earlier this year, Charlene Ward interned for the Allegheny Front as a high school student. She's at Penn State now, but still has fond memories of hiking and sleeping outside at the Crooked Creek Environmental Learning Center near Ford City.
Before I joined the Student Conservation Association, I hated winter, hated being wet from the snow. When I found out that the Conservation Leadership Corps, a community division of the SCA, had its first trip in January 2011, I prepared for a long, painful experience. It was my first SCA trip ever, so I couldn't refuse to go. Instead, I went to Kmart and bought the heaviest, most insulated boots I could, and I packed a duffel bag full of clothes just in case I got wet. And I was still petrified. Apparently, this is pretty common. On a more recent trip, Wesley Smith said,
I keep hearing from people that it's not as bad as people would think, but in my mind, I'm still telling myself it's still a big thing, and I would need like a bunch of equipment.
At least 7 inches of snow fell on our first winter retreat. Luckily, we were staying in a cabin that time. Inside, it was cozy and we could hear the wind whipping against the chimes. But since SCA is a conservation organization, we couldn't stay inside. Our crew leaders dragged us outside almost the entire day. At first, I was miserable. Then I just looked around. I never realized how amazing the woods looked when completely covered in snow, or how remarkably peaceful it was just to sit by a frozen lake. The beauty made being cold so much more bearable. The crew spent much of the day hiking, snowball fighting, playing games, and setting up the campfire. I was having such a good time that I forgot how cold I was. The best part about the trip, and most of my winter trips, was the night hike. I recorded a group that went out in January. As the trudging through the snow started, what most were thinking about was returning to camp. You can hear our crew leader, Katie Horowitz, setting us straight.
Right now we're just going on a hike. I mean, I think we're going to start the fire right as soon as we get back.
The hike surprised me. I never thought I would find the dead silence of winter to be so relaxing. I felt alone with my thoughts. Another crew leader, Dan Malikoff, describes it like this.
What I really like about hiking in the winter is just the stillness of it. There's nothing that moves. You know, there's hardly any animals. When the wind blows, the leaves don't move. You know, and after a while, you really start to just feel very still yourself.
In the past few years, I've been winter camping 6 times, mostly with the Student Conservation Association. I've slept on the cold ground many times, and I have worked cutting trees, building trails, and doing other conservation projects in the cold for hours. I loved every minute of it. One of my favorite trips happened the same year I started. It was mid-March, though it felt more like January. The temperature remained around the teens all day, and the snow was about 8 inches deep. That night we crawled into the Adirondack shelters. Just imagine a small shack missing one of its walls. Ice and frozen mud surrounded the entrances. I won't lie and say that I wasn't freezing that night. My body was fairly warm, though my feet were completely numb. I didn't get the best sleep, but it felt pretty hardcore. I accomplished something most urban kids never will. Levon Ritter expressed this feeling in his own way.
Wrapping in winter is hella tight. When it be all dark at night, it be cold and it be creepy, but it's still fun, like sleeping in a teepee. Word.
What was most gratifying to me about winter camping was that I spent more than 24 hours outside in the deep cold. This is an experience I can laugh about and share when I am older. Heck, I'm even doing it now. I'm thankful that I joined the Student Conservation Association every time I step outside on a cold and snowy winter day. And when I smell a fireplace or a fire pit in my urban neighborhood, it takes me back to the campfire.
That was Charlene Ward, a former intern for the Allegheny Front. For many people, the dream New Year's Eve includes celebrating with champagne, noisemakers, party dresses, and maybe even tearing it up in Times Square. But a couple years ago, on December 31st, the Allegheny Front's Lauren Knapp found herself in Mongolia, ringing in the new year by appreciating the simplicity of a night on Earth.
I was living in Ulaanbaatar, the capital city of Mongolia. Tired of the city's smoke and bustle, a couple of friends and I decided to take a road trip. We would head out east to celebrate with a herding family in their one-room cabin. Our ride was a minivan, circa 1996. An hour into our seven-hour-long journey, we were already off-roading it, following tracks in the snow carved by previous cars and trucks. We drove through the half-frozen rivers and into the snowy ditches. We blew not one, but two tires. Mongolia is a vast country. Only 2.8 million people inhabit a landmass more than twice as big as Texas. And the winters are cold. By the time we neared our destination, it was minus 25 degrees outside, Fahrenheit. So cold, icicles form on your eyelashes. At the cabin, an elderly woman greeted us. She wore a fur hat and dell, a traditional Mongolian coat. The house was roughly the size of a large American living room. She shared it with her husband and son. We slept there on the floor that weekend. The woman made us hot, salty milk tea, a Mongolian staple. Hot tea is more a necessity than indulgence in those temperatures. For supper, we had homemade dumplings filled with onion and horse meat, surprisingly tasty, kind of like venison. We spent the next few days exploring the snow-covered valley on foot and horseback while our hosts went about their daily chores. The old woman milked the cows and goats and prepared food. The men took the livestock out to pasture. In between chores, there was a lot of quiet. Neighbors stopped by on horseback for a chat and some tea. The elderly woman sewed while her husband sat and smoked his hand-rolled cigarettes. Over the course of my time in Mongolia, I met several herders like this family. I would ask them why they stayed on the steppe instead of moving to the city. Everyone agreed there was nothing greater than the freedom of living off the land, an ancient right that has remained mostly unchanged since the days of Genghis Khan. But some things had changed. On New Year's Eve, our host turned on his black and white television. The old man had hooked it up to a satellite dish and solar panel. Almost every herding home has these now. He sat quietly watching the New Year's Eve events in Ulaanbaatar's main square. They had organized an outdoor concert, which, looking back, seems insane given the temperature. As midnight approached, we got out the sparklers we'd brought from the city and lit one for our grandmotherly hostess. This was clearly a new tradition for her. She loved them. For me, New Year's Eve has always been about going out with my friends and dancing until dawn. It's a party. But here I was in the middle of nowhere, our sparklers the only things disrupting the cold night. And all I could think about was how happy I was to be here instead. What better place to reflect on the passing of time? A place where the completely limitless horizon and slowed pace of life is a reminder of where I fit in the world and what truly matters. And that's how you start a new year. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Lauren Knapp.
That was Lauren Knapp. She's completing her documentary on rock music in Mongolia, titled Live from UB. You're listening to a special holiday program from the Allegheny Front. I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan. If you're looking for a gift that keeps giving to you and your world, please consider an end-of-year donation to the Allegheny Front, perhaps made in honor of a loved one. Let us know if you'd like to mention on air your name or the person you're celebrating. Click the donate button at AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for considering this tax-deductible donation. And happy holidays from the Allegheny Front. Throughout the holiday season, bird watchers around the world are staring through binoculars and cupping their ears like Dumbo the elephant to listen closely for birds. They're taking part in the Audubon Society's 114th annual Christmas Bird Count. It started on December 14th and ends January 5th. Birders head to fields, towns, and backyards. The Allegheny Front's Carol Holsapple went to the Lower Buffalo Count in Washington County to find out what it's all about. In the basement of the Taylorstown Christian Church, Larry Helgerman is organizing stacks of Google Maps and birdwatching checklists on long tables which are usually reserved for church suppers. He's been in charge of this bird count for 11 years, and he's all smiles, even though it's still dark outside.
But just keep your checklist separate, okay? If you can.
It's just after 7 a.m., and the bird counters are arriving to pick up their instructions and find out which section of a 15-mile circle they'll cover today. They eat cupcakes with red and green sprinkles and drink coffee as they wait for their assignments.
All areas have a chance of finding good things.
From red cardinals to ring-necked pheasants with rust-colored bellies, young and old bird enthusiasts, men and women from three states and eight counties are participating. About 40 people will count birds from their cars or while walking through nearby fields and roads. Bruce Ettinger has been doing Christmas bird counts since he was a teenager.
It's a very long-lasting, well over 100 years history to the Christmas bird count as an alternative to the rather gruesome custom in the past of going out on Christmas Day and shooting as much wildlife and see who had the biggest pile.
Ettinger's brought his 9-year-old daughter, Erica, for her first count. She's bundled up in a pink hat and carries a tabbed Peterson's Field Guide for Birds. She's got an idea of what she hopes to spot.
Ducks, or Dad said like a tree sparrow would be a good bird to see, or a snowy owl would be a really good bird.
Friends Mary Gray and Robin Eastup are also counting birds today. Eastup claims to be a beginner, but she's got a pair of telltale binoculars that cross behind her back, which all the pros use.
I just really like to come to the Christmas bird counts because especially if it's snowing, it just gets me in the Christmas spirit. You know, I just love it.
And it is snowing, lightly. It's about 30 degrees, but the wind makes it feel colder. Outside the White Country Church, the small town is decked out for Christmas. Many of the old Victorian homes look like gingerbread houses already. Our section is right around the church. Gray says for bird counting, you don't need a lot of equipment, just your ears, eyes, and a checklist of all the birds we might see. She gives a quick bird count 101.
You count the highest number you see. So if you look in a tree and there's, say, four starlings, there's something flying there, Robin, up over those trees, and you look back again and there's six starlings, then you know six. It's not an exact science.
It's citizen science. The data is used to track bird migrations and population changes. It's Sunday morning and the small town roads are quiet. That's a good thing since we're looking up as we walk. There are mourning doves, modos for short, crows, chickadees, a white-breasted nuthatch, male and female juncos, the males are darker, and then, near a backyard bird feeder, something that really gets Gray's attention.
He was on the fence, clinging to the fence, and he flew up, and he's going to be on the side. He's just coming up on the right-hand side of this branch. He's underneath. Come here this way.
It's a brown creeper, working his way from the bottom of the trunk up, looking for insect eggs and larvae.
Brown creeper's a good bird for a town bird.
Did you hear that little high, drawn-out note he just gave Robin? That little chish. Almost sounds like, hear that?
Yeah.
That's him.
Gray says seeing a creeper in a residential area might mean they had a good breeding year, and there are a lot of young birds looking for new territory. Later, Helgerman heads to a marshy area near game lands, where he hopes to see some swamp and white-crowned sparrows. There's still water and lots of seeds here for them to eat, so they may stay through the winter. He trudges through tall brown grass and briars. Waterproof boots are a good idea on a bird count. Helgerman makes a pishing sound to draw out some of the songbirds.
That was one swamp sparrow right there. I know they're in here. And bluebirds. We should be having seen some bluebirds. I haven't even heard any bluebirds yet.
He says anyone can be part of the count. It helps to go out with someone experienced like him
and to keep your ears open.
You don't even pay attention to sounds anymore. Just start to learn to tune in to what you're actually hearing around you. And you'll start hearing squirrels, you'll hear chipmunks, you'll hear all these things that, you know, you were oblivious to.
After about 4 hours, we head back to the church. Mary Gray carves a ham, and the birders are gathering around the tables, eating, warming up, and comparing notes. Erica Edinger wants to talk about one bird her dad saw.
Kestrel.
A kestrel?
Yeah. Well, I might have saw it like flat. I only saw like a silhouette.
With a kestrel added to her list, she has some advice for bird counting success.
I had a lot of jackets and dad brought hot chocolate.
She says she'll be back to check off more birds next year. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Carol Holsapple.
Links to more about Audubon Society Christmas bird counts and backyard feeder watching instructions are at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. When Allegheny Front executive producer Kathy Naur's daughter got the assignment to write a poem, Olivia Naur headed for a winter walk in the park with mom in tow. The 11-year-old's teacher had assigned an acrostic poem, meaning the first letter of each line of the poem created a word. In this case, snowfall.
Stream runs under icicles frozen on the waterfalls. Nothing but tiny hemlocks are green. On bare trees are flakes of snow. Woodpeckers knock on bark, seeking bugs to eat. Fox tracks lead under brush one by one. A flock of hungry cardinals visit the feeder. Lots of flurries flutter gracefully to the ground. Light dims, darkness falls on Frick Park in early winter.
That was Olivia Naur for the Allegheny Front. She's in sixth grade, and this work was just published in the American Library of Poetry's student compilation called Discovered. Thanks for listening to this special holiday edition of the Allegheny Front. On behalf of the Allegheny Front team, Reed Frazier, Julie Grant, Kara Holsapple, Kathy Naur, and myself, may you have a very safe and enjoyable holiday. I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan. Join us again next time for an in-depth reporting project called The Coming Chemical Boom on the Allegheny Front.
The Allegheny Front is supported by the Heinz Endowments and the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of Marcellus Shale, energy, and conservation issues.